Chapter 10, Buddhism and the Nagpur Bar. Dharma Chakra Day was the second most important festival in the Buddhist year. It was the day on which the Buddha, 2 months after his attainment of enlightenment, set in motion the wheel of the law, or, less poetically speaking, started communicating the truth he discovered. Like Vaishakha Purnima, Dharma Chakra Day was a lunar festival, falling on the full moon day of the month Shravana, corresponding to June-July of the Western calendar. This year it had fallen on Thursday the 15th of July, the day of my lecture on The Voice of the Silence. Arriving at Madras Central 3 days later, however, on the morning of Sunday the 18th of July, I found that the Madras Centre of the Mahabodhi Society had yet to celebrate the festival. Whether because a Sunday was more convenient than a weekday, or because I would then be in the city, the celebration had been postponed to that afternoon. There would be a public meeting at 5 o'clock, Venerable Jinananda informed me, after we had exchanged greetings. It would be held at Kennett Lane. There would be 3 speakers, and I would be presiding over the function. At 5 o'clock, I therefore took my place on the stage that had been set up in the courtyard. Jinananda administered the refuges and precepts to the 100 or so people, some of them Buddhists, who had assembled for the occasion, and the meeting proper began. The 3 speakers were all from South India, and all addressed the audience in excellent English, a circumstance that reminded me of the region's proud boast that, although the English language might be forgotten in England, it would never be forgotten in Mylapore. The second and principal speaker was R. Jayachandram, whom I had known when he was a boy in Travancore, and who was now a lecturer in philosophy at the Vivekananda College, one of the city's more prestigious educational institutions. We had renewed our acquaintance prior to the meeting, and reminisced about the time, 6 or 7 years earlier, when he was a student and I one of the 2 long-haired, long-bearded, wandering ascetics then staying at the haunted ashram on the outskirts of the little town of Muvattuputsa. Some of my Buddhism had perhaps rubbed off on him. His lecture, which I was required to announce as being on, quote, "The life of the Buddha is not the story of an avatar, but the story of a man's true emancipation," unquote, was not only very well delivered in a highly poetical style, but also imbued with the speaker's strong feeling for the person of the enlightened one, a feeling especially in evidence when he was describing the Buddha to be's disillusionment with mundane existence, his departure from home, and his early struggles for light. So vividly did Jayachandram describe these events, and to such a degree did he empathize with what he believed were the youthful Siddhartha's thoughts and feelings at the time, that he seemed to have been almost an eyewitness, or even to be speaking from personal experience. If he now and again departed from strict historical accuracy, or showed rather too marked a tendency to sentimentalize the figure of the Buddha, no one appeared to mind, or even to notice, and when he sat down, it was to warm applause. One person there was who did not join in the applause. This was the third and last speaker. As the rather cumbrous title of Jayachandram's address had made clear, the young college lecturer did not believe the Buddha to be an avatar or descent of the god Vishnu, and he in fact had been more than once at pains to remind his audience of that fact, that the founder of Buddhism was a human being who had attained enlightenment by his own human exertions. His successor at the microphone, who from his surname and knew to be a Brahmin, was of a different opinion. The Buddha was an avatar of Vishnu, he insisted. He insisted on the point so vehemently and criticised Jayachandram in such unreasonable terms that the latter could not help retorting, and had I not intervened to restore order, the stage might well have been the scene of an unseemly altercation. Rain, in any case, had started to fall, as if to cool hot tempers, and I proceeded to deliver my presidential address, in the course of which I underlined the principal points made by Jayachandram, and spoke at some length on the danger of Christian missions, the avowed object of which was to destroy the religious and cultural traditions of India. By the time I finished, it was raining heavily, and we were forced to retreat indoors. Here I talked with some of the South Indian Buddhists who had attended the meeting, as well as with two Italian travellers who had come to ask my advice about extending their visas. One of the Italians was eager to visit Tibet, but I assured him that with the Chinese Red Army occupying the country, this was impossible. At 10 the next morning, I gave a lecture at the Vivekananda College, which, as its name suggested, had connections with the Ramakrishna Mission. Swami Vivekananda, after whom the college was named, having been the founder of the mission. The lecture was attended by about 1,000 people, mostly students, and after 5 or 10 minutes of Vedic chanting, I spoke by special request on the differences between the principles of Buddhism and Hinduism. Who asked me to speak on this topic, which was obviously a controversial one, though a Hindu speaker would probably have denied that there was any difference between the two religions, I no longer remember. But whoever it was, I had taken the request seriously, perhaps even as a challenge, and had sat up late the previous night writing my notes. After pointing out that both Hinduism and Buddhism were to be reviewed against the wider background of Indian spiritual tradition, I went on to give a systematic, if somewhat black and white, account of the more important philosophical and ethical differences between them. This took me the best part of an hour, and paved the way for a vigorous attack on the caste system and on orthodox Brahmanism, the exclusiveness and bigotry of which are not only condemned in the roundest terms, but contrasted with the spirit of universality and compassion shown by the Buddha. The attack came as a severe shock to the Brahminical part of the audience, and the principal of the college, who was in the chair, and who was himself a Brahmin, did not know what to say. Many of the students, however, were clearly pleased, and even some of the more orthodox remarked that the Buddhist point of view, though different from that of Brahmanism, was deserving of careful study. The remainder of the day was divided between poetry and philosophy, the former being represented by one Krishnamurti, the poet proprietor of an arts and crafts emporium, who already had presented me with his latest book of English poems, entitled The Cloth of Gold, and the latter by Jayachandram, with whom I had spent the evening discussing Buddhism and other topics of common interest. In the morning, straight after breakfast, I went to see Dr. Natarajan, the scholarly successor of the famous Narayan Guru, who, as Jayachandram had informed me, was then staying in the city. I had met Dr. Natarajan, or Nataraja Guru, as he was also called, once before in Travancore. Circumstances had permitted only the briefest of exchanges, and on the present occasion, too, the interview had to be a short one, as I was seeing him on my way to the station, and had a train to catch. There was time, however, for him to tell me about the radical new interpretation and translation of the Bhagavad Gita, on which he was then working, and had in fact been working on for a number of years. At Madras Central, I located my berth, bought a volume of English essays at the station bookstall, said goodbye to Jinanda, and settled myself for the journey. Punctually, at 9:15, whistles blew, doors were slammed, and I was on my way, not to Calcutta, but to Nagpur. Nagpur, 500 miles from Madras, and situated at the exact geographical centre of India, was the capital of Madhya Pradesh. Though it lay on the main line between Bombay and Calcutta, and though I had passed through it several times, I knew little more about it than that it was the orange-growing capital of India, and the headquarters of the Rashtriya Sevak Sangh, or National Service Association, an ultra-nationalist right-wing Hindu organisation, one of whose members had assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. In recent months I had become more aware of the place's existence. Venerable Sila Bhadra, one of my colleagues on the editorial board of the Mahabodhi, had lectured there on Buddha and Buddhism at the invitation of the local Ramakrishna Ashram, then celebrating its silver jubilee. And I had been in correspondence with A.R. Kulkarni, the secretary of the Buddha Society, Nagpur, who was a supporter of the Mahabodhi Society and an occasional contributor to its journal. Either Kulkarni suggested I might like to visit Nagpur, or I suggested the Buddha Society might like to invite me. Whichever it was, a visit had been arranged, and I now was making a grand detour and returning to Calcutta from Madras by way of Nagpur. During the whole day, only three other persons entered the compartment, and I spent the time immersed in my volume of essays. At 10 o'clock in the evening, as we were passing through Hyderabad State, a group of three Muslims got on for an hour. It was a rather unusual group, consisting of a well-built police inspector, a handsome young man, and a very pretty boy. Soon the police inspector was arguing politics with a Tamil Brahmin, who already occupied one of the berths, while his two companions, who may or may not have understood English, sat quietly beside him. 12 hours later, the train reached Nagpur. Kulkarni was waiting for me on the crowded platform. A middle-aged man of medium height, he was clad simply in a white kurta and dhoti, and was shaven-headed, though without the crown lock that denoted the orthodox Hindu. As I later discovered, he saw himself as a Hindu follower of the Buddha, rather than as a Buddhist, which explained why the organisation of which he was secretary, and of which he was indeed the founder and moving spirit, was a Buddha society and not a Buddhist society. A taxi conveyed us to his residence in Dharampeth, which, as its name implied, was, or had been once, a Brahmin locality, where I met his doctor brother and his two teenage nephews. The women remained in the background, cooking and washing clothes and drawing water from the well in the yard. After we had discussed the condition of Buddhism in Nagpur, it was not good, and I had had lunch and written a letter to Kalimpong, he took me with him to see various people who would, he thought, be interested in arranging lectures. We did not meet with much success. The registrar of the university, a UP Brahmin, did not respond at all favourably to my host's suggestions that I should deliver a lecture in the convocation hall. Indeed, it was my impression that the forthrightness of Kulkarni's approach and the bluntness of his manner, which made a suggestion seem very much like an order, rather disconcerted him, not to say annoyed him. The fact was that Kulkarni was by birth a Maharashtrian Brahmin, and Maharashtrian Brahmins, as I had yet to learn, were renowned for their harshness and militancy, though the Deshastra Brahmins, of whom Kulkarni was one, were much less harsh and militant than the Chitpavans. At the Ramakrishna Ashram, which we visited next, and where we met the two resident Swamis, one young and one old, we fared hardly better than we had done at the university. While young Swami was interested in my giving a lecture there, old Swami very clearly was not, perhaps because they had already had a lecture on Buddhism that year, or because Srila Bhadra's lecture had not been to his liking. In the end, it was agreed that if it was possible for them to arrange a lecture for us, they would let us know. With the Theosophists, we were more fortunate. A Bengali follower of Madame Blavatsky assured us that there would be no difficulty in arranging for me to speak at the local T.S. Lodge, and promised to ask the lodge secretary to get in touch with us. The rest of the afternoon, as well as most of the evening, was spent visiting first the Buddha Society's library and reading room, then a temple where an image of the Buddha had been installed, and finally the headquarters of the State Congress. By the time we returned to Dharampeth, I was feeling rather tired. Kulkarni, despite his 50-odd years, was still full of energy, and bustled about preparing English tea for me. The following morning it became apparent that our labours of the previous day had not been in vain. From breakfast time until well after midday, there was a constant flow of visitors, several of whom either wanted to arrange lectures or had already done so. The principal of the Science College had arranged one for that very evening. The secretary of the T.S. Lodge wanted to arrange one for the following Saturday, it was then Thursday, while a brahmachari or novice from the Ramakrishna Ashram came with an invitation to speak there the following Sunday. Young Swami had somehow managed to persuade old Swami. The result was that for that and the next 3 days, I was kept busy preparing and giving what seemed an uninterrupted stream of lectures and addresses. Kulkarni, who was a lawyer by training, kept a faithful record of them all, and an article from his pen entitled Bhikshu Shangracharya's Lecture Tour in Nagpur eventually appeared in the Mahabodhi and elsewhere. Many of the details of where I spoke, to whom, and what I said had vanished from my recollection even before the article appeared. On the other hand, incidents of which he made no mention, and of which he was probably quite unaware, were indelibly impressed on my mind. Biography and memoirs supplement and correct each other, especially when the biographer writes about the memoirist from personal knowledge. Concerned as it was with my public activities rather than with my private ones, Kulkarni's article naturally began with my visit to the Buddha Society's library and reading room. Quote, on the very first day of his arrival, Reverend Bhikshu Shangracharya paid a visit to the library of the Buddha Society, Nagpur, which is located in City Baldi, in the magnificent building of Dada Saheb Dhanwali, known as Dhanwali Chamber. After this, the revered Bhikshu paid a visit to the Siddhartha Bhagyodaya Library, located in the Vithal Rukmini Deosathan Temple, City Baldi, Nagpur. The revered Bhikshu was immensely pleased to notice the beautiful image of the Buddha installed in the temple in the heart of the Nagpur city. The revered Bhikshu then paid a visit to the Abhyankar Congress House and attended the mass common prayer conducted therein. Sri A.R. Kulkarni recited Tri Sarana and Panchasila, and the revered Bhikshu made a short speech explaining their meaning. The audience was spellbound when the Bhikshu was delivering his sermon. Dhanwali Chamber may or may not have been a magnificent building, but the 100 or so Hindi, Marathi and English volumes, some of them on Buddhism, that form the Society's library, certainly could not be considered a magnificent collection. Running the library was, however, the Society's one permanent activity, and apart from Kulkarni's occasional lectures, it had for some years past been virtually the only sign of Buddhist activity in Nagpur. Another excerpt from Kulkarni's article, quote, on the second day, that is, on July 22nd, the revered Bhikshu gave a lecture in the Science College Hostel on Buddhism and the Modern World under the presidentship of Dr. Krishnamurti, Principal, Science College, Nagpur. In his opening address, Dr. Krishnamurti pointed out how Buddhism was the purified form of Hinduism. The learned Bhikshu told the science students how Buddhism inculcated a scientific attitude in man. Buddhism never believed in accepting anything on trust. Come and see for yourself is the motto of Buddhism. It was for this reason the most rationalistic religion on earth. The learned Bhikshu aptly pointed out that there was never any conflict between Buddhism and science. The lecture had an abiding effect on the students, who actually declared their faith in Buddhism by saying, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. Unquote. As my lecture lasted for an hour and a half, Kulkarni's account of it was not even a summary. Probably I was at pains to rebut Krishnamurti's assertion that Buddhism was a purified form of Hinduism. But I no doubt did this gently, as the principal of the science college was a friendly, likeable man, and I had no wish to injure his feelings. The attitude inculcated in man by Buddhism was, of course, scientific, only in the wider sense of its being objective, as I must have explained. Similarly, Buddhism's come and see meant not that it was rationalistic, a word I never used in this connection, but that it was rational, a very different thing. As for the dozens of students who, at the conclusion of my lecture, thronged round me with joyful shouts of Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, I go for refuge to the Buddha, they were members of the scheduled castes and followers of Dr. Ambedkar. Once again, coming events were casting their shadow before. another excerpt from Kulkarni's article. Quote, on the 23rd of July, the revered Bhikshu delivered a learned discourse on Buddhism in the Nagpur Mahavidyalaya under the auspices of the Philosophical Society of the College and under the presidentship of Professor Ramnathan, Vice Principal of the College. Earlier, the revered Bhikshu had delivered a discourse on the Dharma Chakra under the auspices of the Harijan Sewa Sangh. The occasion was the mass spinning program organized by the Sarvodaya workers of Nagpur to commemorate the 86th birthday of Mahatma Gandhi. The function was attended by Sri R. K. Patil, ex-minister, Sri Rauka, Sri Wazala, and other eminent Sarvodaya workers. The whole audience was highly impressed by the learned and illuminating discourse delivered by the revered Bhikshu. After questions and answers, the function terminated. Sri R. K. Patil was also presented in the evening function held in the Nagpur Mahavidyalaya. Unquote. The 50-odd Sarvodaya workers taking part in the mass spinning program were the biggest collection of freaks and eccentrics I had seen for a long time. Old rather than young, and clad or half-clad in coarse white homespun, they were wild-eyed, long-haired, and in some cases long-bearded. Some tried to carry on hand-spinning when they stood up to address the audience. Others spoke with the most extraordinary gestures, at times touching the ground with one hand while simultaneously shooting the other towards the ceiling. The most sensible-looking person present was a local mill owner in a white Gandhi cap, who sat silent and impassive, and without a chaka, to one side. The Sarvodaya workers were all disciples of Vinoba Bhave, whose proposal to enhance the importance of Bodh Gaya by building there a temple of his own, I had recently ridiculed in the Mahabodhi. Gandhi's economic ideals, of which Bhave was the principal inheritor and custodian, appealed to me strongly. The Mahatma's Hind Swaraj was one of the first books I read after my arrival in India. But if those ideals depended for their implementation on Bhave's Sarvodaya movement, as represented by the present collection of crackpots, then I, for one, could not see them transforming Indian society. Quote, on July the 24th, the learned Bhikshu delivered at 5 p.m. a lecture on Buddhism, the Gospel of Action, in the Hislop College, Nagpur, under the auspices of the Philosophical Society of that college. Sri Padier, Professor of Philosophy, presided. The learned lecturer pointed out in the course of his stirring lecture how Buddhism was essentially a religion of action. This lecture created a favourable impression on the younger generation who mostly attended it. Immediately after this lecture was over, the revered Bhikshu delivered at 6:30 at the Theosophical Lodge, Dantoli, a lecture on Buddhism and Theosophy. The learned Bhikshu pointed out the many common points between Buddhism and Theosophy, and laid particular emphasis on the universal brotherhood of man, which was an essential feature both of Theosophy and Buddhism. The Theosophical Lodge was packed to its full capacity, and the entire audience was listening to the discourse with rapt attention. The simple but easy flowing style of the learned Bhikshu created a deep impression on the audience, and they thought that they were listening to something which they had not witnessed before. In fact, the revered Bhikshu's lectures had created a sensation in Nagpur. Unquote. The Hislop College lecture was delivered at the invitation of the students themselves, two of whom had come only that very morning to ask me to address them. Buddhism was a religion of action, but not of activism. It was a religion of action in that it recognized the law of karma, the law in accordance with which impure actions of body, speech and mind were followed by suffering and pure ones by happiness. Thus, Buddhism was a religion of ethics. Meditation consisted essentially in an uninterrupted succession of ethically pure mental actions or skillful volitions. That is, in an uninterrupted succession of mental actions free from greed, hatred, and delusion. Quote, on the morning of July the 25th, the revered Bhikshu went to the village of Bahadma, at a distance of about 7 miles from Nagpur, to witness the anti-untouchability campaign launched by Sri Raukaji and others. On this occasion, the revered Bhikshu delivered a speech before the villagers in English, which was rendered into Marathi by Sri A.R. Kulkarni. In the course of his very simple but convincing speech, the revered Bhikshu laid emphasis on unity in life and pointed out how disunity amongst them may lead to their ruin. Unquote. For the last mile of the journey we had to walk, threading our way between the paddy fields along the narrow raised paths. On our arrival in the village, we had breakfast with Sri Raukaji and other members of the Harijan Sewa Sangh in an untouchable hut. Harijans, or Children of God, was Mahatma Gandhi's name for the untouchables, but many of them rejected the designation as a condescending euphemism. While we were having breakfast, I had an experience that affected me more strongly than anything else I saw or heard during my visit to Nagpur. We were seated directly on the beaten earth floor of the hut. In front of each of us was a thali, and beside the thali, a brass tumbler. On picking up the tumbler beside my own thali and raising it to my lips, I found the water in it so thick with ochre-coloured clay as to be opaque. What was the reason? I asked. Apologetically, our host explained that untouchables were not allowed to draw water from the village well. They were therefore obliged to take it from the river, which at that time of year was naturally very turbid. Not allowed to draw water from the village well? Not even during the rainy season? Those few simple words, spoken quietly and without bitterness, seemed to sum up all the wrongs the untouchables had suffered down the ages at the hands of the caste Hindus. They haunted me for months afterwards, and I never forgot them. Quote, at 4 p.m. the revered Bhikshu recited the Mangala Sutta at the residence of Dr. D.R. Kulkarni in the true Buddhist style, and explained its meaning in English, which was rendered into Marathi by Sri A.R. Kulkarni. This was a sort of private, informal function attended by the members of Dr. Kulkarni's family and his personal friends, viz. Rao Bahadur D.K. Mohoin and Sri M.Y. and Mrs. Kohli and others. Unquote. Besides his two sons, Dr. Kulkarni's family consisted of his wife and a grown-up daughter who was at medical college. The previous day, the two women, together with the elderly maidservant and a little girl, who may or may not have been a relation, had been formally presented to me. Dressed in their best saris, bejewelled, and with flowers in their hair, they had come forward one by one, had silently touched my feet, and then had withdrawn. During the whole course of my stay, they did not address a single word to me, any more than I did to them, but they were very much aware of my presence in the house, as I well knew, and did their best to meet, and even anticipate, my material needs. With Dr. Kulkarni and his sons, I naturally had more contact, as I also had, to an even greater degree, with the indefatigable brother of the one and uncle of the others. More than once did I sit on the flat roof of the house with the doctor and his elder son, Krishna, discussing Buddhism, until long past midnight. My discussions with Kulkarni usually took place during the intervals between lectures, especially when the two of us were travelling by car or cycle rickshaw to the next venue, or when we were waiting for a bus. In the course of these discussions, I learned, bit by bit, of the circumstances that had led him, a Dishastra Brahmin by birth and a lawyer by profession, to declare himself a follower of the Buddha and to dedicate his life to the task of making India so-called Buddha-minded. It was an interesting story and began 20 years earlier in the Nagpur High Court. A Hindu monk from the Punjab had come and taken up residence in a deserted Shiva temple in Nagpur. The monk belonged to the Manu Bhava sect, the members of which worshipped not Shiva but Vishnu, particularly in his avatar as Krishna. The preacher of the Bhagavad Gita and lover of the gopis or cowherd maidens. After taking up residence in the temple, the Mahanubhava monk installed there an image of Krishna, as a result of which the Krishna temple, as it now was, became a popular place of worship for the local Hindus. At this point, a Sanatani or Orthodox monk, who, as a follower of the non-dualist philosopher Shankara, was a worshipper of Shiva, filed a civil suit against the Mahanubhava monk, contending that the temple had been built by his guru, and that on the latter's death he, the plaintiff, was its rightful owner. He further contended that the temple was a Sanatani temple, and that the Mahanubhava monk, not being a Sanatani Hindu, had no right to reside there, and no right to manage the place as he was doing. Kulkarni appeared in the case for the defendant. He had already appeared for him in the criminal case that had preceded the civil suit, and which the Sanatani monk, then also the plaintiff, had lost. This case did not really form part of Kulkarni's story, and I in fact learned about it only much later on one of my subsequent visits to Nagpur. In the civil suit, there were three questions to be determined. 1. What was a Hindu? 2. Were Mahanubhavas Hindus? 3. What was the difference between a Hindu and a Sanatani Hindu? Under cross-examination, the plaintiff defined a Hindu as one who believed in the authority of the Vedas, admitted that the Mahanubhavas were Hindus, and averred that a Sanatani Hindu is one who, on the authority of the Vedas, believed, as the Mahanubhavas did not, in the caste system and untouchability. In support of his contention that the Mahanubhavas, though Hindus, were not Sanatani Hindus, he called as witnesses a number of Brahmin pundits, the most eminent of whom Kulkarni cross-examined at some length. From this pundit he elicited statements to the effect that the caste system was based on birth, not on merit, that Tukaram, the famous poet saint of Maharashtra, despite his spiritual attainments, was to be classed as a Shudra, which he was by birth, not as a Brahmin, and that the Buddha was not an authority on religion. These uncompromising statements shocked and distressed Kulkarni, the more especially as they represented the considered opinion of a Brahmin pundit well versed in the Hindu scriptures. He realized that in Orthodox Hinduism there was no place for social justice, and that the very people who were supposed to teach the principles of true religion were themselves ignorant of those principles. The only remedy for such a state of affairs, he concluded, was the Buddha. Only the Buddha could remove the evils of caste, untouchability, and communalism from the present-day Indian society. With the help of friends and well-wishers, he therefore founded in Nagpur in 1944 a Buddha society, with himself as secretary. As I discovered later, the principal supporters of the little organization were all Maharashtrian Brahmins and all members of the legal profession. Between Buddhism and the Nagpur Bar, there seemed to be a definite connection. There was also a connection between Buddhism and the Nagpur bench, the president of the society being a judge of the Nagpur High Court. The connection between Buddhism and the Nagpur Bar, at least, was not a new one. Both then, and in the course of my subsequent visits to Nagpur, Kulkarni was wont to reminisce not only about the Mahanubhava case, but also about some of his other experiences as a lawyer. In particular, he reminisced about the legal giants, both British and Indian, who had dominated the Nagpur High Court in the days of the Raj. Prominent among these legendary figures was Sir Hari Singh Gur, about whose forensic battles Kulkarni had many a story to tell, and whom he, as a young lawyer, had evidently much admired. The name of Sir Hari Singh Gur was not unknown to me. He was the author of Spirit of Buddhism, a substantial and scholarly work on the life, teaching and influence of the Buddha that had been published soon after my birth, and which, as a teenager who recently had realized that he was a Buddhist, I had devoured back in the early 40s. 2 years after the founding of the Buddha Society, Kulkarni experienced a further shock. In order to popularize the Buddha and make the people of India Buddha-minded, as he put it, he had started celebrating Buddha Jayanti every year on the Vaishakha Purnima. Significantly, it had not been celebrated in Nagpur before. And in 1946, invited Tuklok Ji Maharaj, the well-known musician saint of Maharashtra, to sing bhajans, or devotional songs, on the thrice-sacred day. Tuklok Ji Maharaj being extremely popular, and his bhajans greatly appreciated, the function was a huge success. 20,000 people attended. Afterwards, however, as the crowds dispersed, Kulkarni heard several people asking, "Who is this Buddha whose Jayanti is being celebrated today?" These inquiries shocked and distressed him even more than the Brahmin pundits' uncompromising statements had done 2 years earlier. That the Buddha, who was the glory of India, should be unknown in the land of his birth was intolerable. It was a stigma on the fair name of India. The stigma must be removed. Who would remove it? He would undertake to do so. A few weeks later, he therefore gave up his practice as a lawyer and became a homeless beggar for the sake of the Dharma. When he came to this part of the story, Kulkarni was so overcome that he shed a few tears, as he would do on future occasions when he related it to me, and I saw that he was a man not only of iron determination, but of powerful emotions. Having given up his practice, he paraded the streets of Nagpur every morning, reciting the refuges and precepts, distributing pamphlets, and calling out, "O noble sons of Bharat, arise, awake, remove the thorn of misery, and be happy. Destroy casteism, destroy communalism, destroy untouchability, destroy Brahmanism, preach the Dharma of humanity. Love mankind and glorify the Buddha." Though he had kept this up for several years, even extending his activities beyond Nagpur, the noble sons of Bharat had so far shown little sign of responding to his appeal. The Buddha Society had not grown, being still confined, more or less, to a handful of Brahmin lawyers. But Kulkarni was not disheartened. He still wanted to make the people of India Buddha-minded, and was overjoyed that I was visiting Nagpur and that my lectures were proving a success. Quote, "At 7:30 p.m., the learned Bhikshu delivered his last lecture at the Srivananda Hall of the Ramakrishna Mission. The subject of this lecture was the spiritual path in Buddhism. By this time, the revered Bhikshu's fame had spread far and wide in Nagpur, and therefore this lecture attracted a large audience. In fact, the entire Srivananda Hall was packed to the full. The audience was easily about 300, and was a distinguished one, which included many prominent persons. The meeting was presided over by Swami Bashkeshwarananda. The revered Bhikshu, in the course of his lecture, pointed out how spirituality was of the essence of Buddhism, and how there could be no progress in spirituality unless we laid stress on ethics and on renunciation. An emphasis on the Panchasila was the right emphasis in life. The learned Bhikshu further pointed out that the regular practice of meditation was indispensable to the higher life, and that nirvana could be attained only by the complete elimination of the concept of ego. The learned president, in the course of his presidential speech, profusely praised the lecturer and underlined the need for renunciation and meditation. After the lecture was over, there was a rush towards the revered Bhikshu, as everybody wanted to have a look at the young English monk." Unquote. People seemed to be struck as much by the speaker's youth as by the fact that he was a Westerner, as indeed had been the case in Bangalore. Not that I was really so very young. I was in my 28th year, though being shaven-headed probably made me look younger than I actually was. In India, religious knowledge tended to be associated with age, notwithstanding the fact that youthful, even 16-year-old gurus were not unknown to tradition. Quote, in fact, many institutions in Nagpur wanted to arrange the lecture of the learned bhikshu, but they were disappointed, as the bhikshu had no time. The revered bhikshu left Nagpur by Calcutta mail on July the 26th. Unquote. I had no time because there was an issue of the Mahabodhi waiting to be brought out. Otherwise, I would gladly have stayed longer in Nagpur. Not only could I then have given more lectures, I could also have spent more time with my host and his family and got to know them better. Short though my stay beneath their hospitable roof had been, there was already a good deal of warmth between us, and when the time came for us to say our goodbyes soon after breakfast, they were all subdued and sad. Krishna and his brother Raja, particularly, were quite affected. Krishna was so affected, in fact, that he did not come to the station, and I was seen off by the two elder Kulkarnis and Raja. Rather unusually, the compartment in which I had a reserved berth, and where the three of them sat and talked with me until the train's departure, was otherwise unoccupied, so that for the early part of my journey, I was able to sit back and think my own thoughts without fear of interruption. The visit had been a memorable one. I felt moved by all the devotion I had encountered and wondered what I had done to deserve it. In the course of the day, only two or three people got into the compartment, with one of whom, the Punjabi manager of a Birla concern, I had a little conversation before sleeping. The following morning, having enjoyed a good night's rest, I talked with some of the passengers who had joined us during the hours of darkness, including a young Bengali who turned out to be the nephew of someone I knew, and an MP from Orissa who was deeply interested in Tantric Buddhism. Thus, the time passed pleasantly, so that when the train reached Howrah station, I hardly noticed that we were 3 hours late. Soon I had crossed the mighty cantilevered span of Howrah Bridge and was making my way through the congested streets of Borough Bazaar to College Square and the Mahabodhi Society. Within hours of my arrival at the headquarters building, I received a nasty shock. While I was away, a meeting of the editorial board of the Mahabodhi had been held, and at this meeting, as a copy of the minutes informed me, decisions had been taken which were plainly designed to check me in my work for the journal and make it virtually impossible, in fact, for me to carry on. These treacherous and underhand proceedings angered me considerably. I flatly told Silabhadra, who was the prime mover in the business, that I proposed to take no notice of the editorial board's decisions, and asked Jinnaratna to call a special meeting of the board. I then made up the August issue, and the following morning, after heated exchange with my two yellow-robed colleagues, the third, the Pacific Dharmaratna, was either away or remained in his room, began sending it to the press as usual, though without going through all the channels I was now supposed to go through, and without first obtaining the approval of all the people whose approval I was now supposed to obtain. The special meeting, held a week later, was a stormy affair, but despite Silabhadra's determined opposition, I carried the day, and with the rather lukewarm support of Dr. Kalidas Nag, the chairman of the board, and Dr. Nalinaksha Dutt, managed to have the decisions previously taken rescinded. What with proofreading and counteracting the machinations of Silabhadra and Jinnaratna, at one stage they even tried to intercept my letters to members of the governing body. The time between my arrival and the holding of the special meeting was a busy one, so that, with the exception of Soratha, who lived on the premises, I could see little of my Calcutta friends. After the special meeting, however, I was able to see more of them, especially Pani Sanyal at his father, and Sachin's relations at Hindustan Building. I was even able to pay a visit to the Kamalalaya Book Department, where I bought a copy of Jeed's If It Die. Nonetheless, the atmosphere at the headquarters building was such that I had no wish to stay longer than was absolutely necessary, and accordingly left Calcutta after spending little more than a week there. Saurartha, who had sympathised with me throughout, and who had written about my difficulties to Deva Priyaji, then still in Japan, accompanied me to Silda Station and saw me off. During the daytime I talked with a Baptist missionary and pointed out in very strong terms the shortcomings of the Christian missions. In the evening we crossed the Ganges, and from the upper deck of the paddle steamer I watched the rose-red disk of the sun drop with increasing rapidity beneath the grey horizon. The night was very warm, and my berth so infested with bedbugs I was unable to sleep. Between Siliguri and Teesta Bridge there were some 40 landslides. Once I had to transship, scrambling knee-deep in mud along the mountainside for about 30 yards, with a sheer drop to the swollen waters of the river far below. At midday I reached Kalimpong and the Hermitage. Hasta arrived soon afterwards with a companion, then Sachin's cousin Durga, whom I had recently started teaching, then Sachin himself with a big bundle of mail, and finally Anandji. I was relieved to be back and overjoyed to be once again surrounded by friends. End of chapter 10.